Good morning and welcome to our virtual meeting. It's 9 a.m. on June 1st, 2021, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. In accordance with Governor's Proclamation 20-28.15, we are holding meetings remotely today. Online, we have Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, Commissioner Tony Olson, John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Ann Spangler, our General Counsel, Melissa Collins, our Commission Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, our Assistant Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Lila Wall, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute and turn off the camera on your devices when not speaking. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. If there's public request to comment and time remains, 15 minutes will be allowed at the end of the morning briefing session. First up, we have our item one, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. Happy Tuesday after a long weekend. I hope everybody had the opportunity to enjoy the phenomenal weather we had this weekend. It was just gorgeous. The downside for me is my grandson just left 5 minutes ago, but had a fantastic weekend camping and goofing off with him. So first up is our media update, and that's going to be with Aaron Sweeney. Good morning, Aaron.
Morning, everybody. How's it going, commissioners? I hope everyone had a great Memorial Day weekend. Like John said, the weather was amazing, so that's great. I'm pinch hitting for Julie. That's in honor of the Mariners' five-game winning streak, right? So I'm excited to be able to share the recent media coverage we've got. So first, let me start with the fun story that appeared in the Herald on Sunday on the kayakers going down the Solden River. What a great story that was. Kelly Stickney and I worked with a Herald reporter and photographer a couple weeks kind of setting that up. We actually went out there on the day of the event, hiked them down the Solden Canyon Trail, watched the kayakers go off. Drove them around to the diversion dam, got some other great photos of them. And they gave us some GoPro footage. That was the videos that showed up. Overall, I think a really great story. And I think a story that really gave us an opportunity to talk about how we care for the river. And that includes letting local folks use it for recreational opportunities. So overall, I think that was a great story that was in the Herald this weekend. Next, I wanted to highlight the media attention that we've gotten from our Flex Energy pilot launch. We had a nice story in the Herald the morning of the launch. We've also had a bunch of other media coverage from local papers and blogs. I actually went on the radio on Cairo and KRKO and did some radio interviews and kind of chatted with them about the program. You know, we talked about how this is a complex program, and I think getting the information out there and just kind of talking about it with customers is really helping, and we're seeing that with some of the signups. So that's good. We also launched our commercial electric vehicle incentives for businesses, and that got some press in the Linwood Today and My Everett News blogs, and that's going around now. Our microgrid continues to really show up in the press. Actually, today we were included in a Public Power Daily article about DOE releasing a tracking tool for like local microgrids. So they mentioned our microgrid again, which they've done a number of times. Also, our Scott Gibson worked with PNNL on an article on the innovative fire suppression technology that's in our battery storage unit. And that showed up, strangely enough, in the India Daily News. So it's the weird thing about, the internet, things can go pretty wide and far, and our microgrid continues to really get good press. One thing that showed up in the press a couple weeks ago was the big earthquake series in the Herald. And it really points out one of the unique parts of working with the press. We actually worked with the reporter on that last summer. And that's why Cale Thompson was actually quoted in the article. But that was a chance for us to talk about the damage that would happen to our infrastructure during an earthquake and how restoration efforts would commence after that and how long it might take to get customers up. So kind of a strange deal where we worked with a reporter a long time ago and it's actually just came to print now. Finally, our Herald column in May was on water. We were able to highlight the 75th anniversary of our water utility and the wonders of hydropower. So all in all, I think a great month of media attention. And any questions?
Questions, commissioners, for Aaron?
I have none.
Nope, I have none either.
Thank you, Aaron. Those were great stories, the kayaking story, the earthquake stories. I noticed the reporter, I don't think, is no longer with the Herald either.
No, Julia Grace left. She's actually at the health district now doing grant writing for them. So,
great.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Next up is our legislative update. And I questions only as far as the legislative information that was provided in the packet. But Kim Johnson does want to just mention or give a very brief update on the Columbia River Treaty. So first questions for Kim on the legislative information that was in the package, and then Kim can get into the CRT.
Any questions on the packet, commissioners?
If I can jump in quickly on the packet and just provide a little bit of context in the federal section, you know, we're starting to see a lot of activity pick up in DC. I mentioned two bills in particular in this this report here. I don't traditionally include bills that are so early in the committee process, but these felt noteworthy because the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill, as you can see, was a bipartisan bill, which I found noteworthy, and it included some EV provisions in it, which is a good sign that those types of investments will be included, whether it's in the Surface Transportation Reauthorization or a larger transportation package. There's clearly bipartisan support for those. On the tax bill, we're going to continue to see, from a public power perspective, the need to fight for parity on these issues. And I wanted to flag this, while it's not certain that this will survive, you know, the remaining process, it's a very good sign. We worked with APPA, LPPC, some of our other trade groups, as well as our own individual relationships to make this amendment successful through this part of the process to make sure that public power had parity on these tax issues. So two noteworthy things in the report.
I have a question, Kim. Commissioner Wolf here. Do you know if APPA, supported by us and many, many other utilities, do you know if APPA is supporting or giving input on the Bennett bill, the one on fire? I mean, there's a lot about fire in it. I have a handout on it. I could.
If you can give me a bill number, I'm happy to look into it and loop back with you on that.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, it's a really good bill, I think, from what I can tell. So, okay, thanks. That's all.
Happy to.
Yeah.
All right.
Any other questions on the report?
I don't think so. Thank you, Kim.
All right. I do want to find a quick update on the Columbia River Treaty. This is an issue we haven't talked about in a bit. With the change in administration, Snohomish PUD, as well as the Columbia River Treaty Power Group, has really made a strong effort to re-engage across DC on this issue and to try and pull this issue from the back burner to the front burner. So I just wanted to make you all aware that in the last couple of months, we've met with, I'd say, approximately 15 different House and Senate offices in the region and with key positions on committees. We've had Senator Maria Cantwell to a power group meeting to discuss the issue. We have met with the Corps of Engineers on this issue. We sat down and invited BPA Administrator Hairston to our meeting and have discussed the issue with him, as well as John was able to participate in a meeting with the White House on Friday to, again, raise awareness on this issue and talk about the need to modernize the treaty for us and our customers and the major impact that it has for the region. So I just wanted you all to know this is a top priority in terms of trying to actually gain some momentum on the issue that has stretched on far too long already. So we're working hard. Appreciate that John took the time on Friday to meet with the White House. It was a successful meeting by my measure. It sounds like they do view this as a priority. Want to engage with us going forward, which is nice to hear.
Jim, Commissioner Olson,
Go ahead, Commissioner Olson.
The Commissioner Olson, the White House, did that then include the State Department?
Yeah, the lead negotiator was in the meeting.
Okay.
So yes, the State Department. department was present.
Kim, is there any appetite in the administration to give cancellation notice if things don't get moving quickly, or what are your thoughts about that?
So the power group has been lobbying pretty hard, saying that it's time to use that tool to, our end goal is not to terminate the treaty. Our end goal is to create some leverage in the negotiation with Canada. And we did bring that up in all of our meetings. I would not say that the White House, what I would say is the White House is willing to look at all tools available to them and shares our common interest in trying to modernize the treaty. We didn't have a lot of conversation specifically about the notice to terminate, but you know, this was the first of what we hope is many conversations, and we just wanted to hear that they view it as important and that they are going to have a lot of people engaged on the issue across departments and agencies. And we did we walked away with that feeling from the meeting.
Right, right.
This Commissioner Olson again, so then are they directly engaged with the parties and the Canadian government?
There's a group of people that are engaged, in the actual negotiations.
Okay. Over the years, those things have gone well and not well, and it's been bumped from one group to another. So, but those communications are ongoing within the new administration.
But the State Department is the one that eventually will make the decision, right? I mean, but they're connected, with the president. But the thing that is interesting to me, I know that it's cost us a lot of money and that needs to change. But the thing that I think is really important is the ecosystem health part. The tribes and all of the environmental groups and many people in the power industry care about this, that the health of the Columbia River agreement be, that needs to be a priority, the ecosystem health.
Yeah, and if you recall, there is the regional recommendation, and mm-hmm. that was part of the regional recommendation.
Right.
And the power group is, as we're trying to ramp this issue up, we are working on setting up meetings to reengage with our, peers in the tribal community mm-hmm. on their engagement on the issue as well.
If there's any opportunity for commissioners to participate, I would be very, I've been following this for years as well. So would, love to somehow be involved. If there is an opportunity for any commissioners to do that. Okay, just so you know. Okay.
All right, any other questions for Kim?
Commissioner Logan, I was just gonna pile on a little bit to Kim's comments, which were absolutely spot on, but the Columbia River Treaty is a significant opportunity for us financially, resource adequacy, environmental, climate change. It's huge for Snohomish and it's huge for the Pacific Northwest utility industry. And I was really encouraged walking away from the meeting with the White House on Friday that at least it seems that it has the right people's attention. So encouraged by that and encouraged. And I will say also that Kim and her peers, but I'll be biased towards Kim, has played a huge role in getting this to where it is now with the recognition and attention from the State Department and the White House and our delegation in the Pacific Northwest. So a huge kudos to Kim on this.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, John.
Okay, next up is, and I'm excited about this, we have Melissa Collins and our consultant, Sherelle Gordon, to give us an update on our DEI efforts. Good morning, Sherelle. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
Morning.
So commissioners, we have Sherelle here, who you know is our consultant with RootWorks. she's joining today as we provide you with a DEI update. As you may recall, the district hired Sherelle back in June 2020, and the PUD's DEI initiative began in July, which was to facilitate a staff-led process to deepen our understanding of staff experiences and to devise recommendations for a more welcoming and valued environment. The first phase of the initiative focused on an initial assessment and listening tour of the DEI landscape for staff, which was conducted in the winter of 2020 and consisted of ongoing desk review of our HR policies related to DEI, a written survey of staff, one-on-one interviews with self-selected staff, and consultations with leadership. The listening tour was completed in February, this past February 2021, and results were communicated to staff. These findings identified three areas that contributed to staff feeling unwelcomed or valued. We are currently in phase two, which includes analyzing the findings and proposing a plan. We want to see change happen on an organizational level that will impact individual experiences of feeling welcomed and valued. The plan that we create will respond to three key issues. One, women feeling unwelcomed and devalued. Two, managers' competency and consistency. And three, accountability for all around these behaviors. As part of the DEI initiative plan, a DEI committee would be formed and tasked with creating relevant recommendations to respond to the listening tour findings and to support the PUD culture and staff. Again, to make everyone feel welcome and valued. Sherelle was able to join us for about 2.5 days this past May, last month, to begin training sessions with our DE committee members and our senior managers, and she continued her HR process review. The DEI committee will begin meeting twice a month starting this month in June, and we will continue over the next several months and hopefully some more in-person trainings with Sherelle later on this summer. So with that, I'll turn it over to Sherelle if she wants to add anything or answer any questions that you might have. Sherelle?
I definitely am here to answer any questions, and I'll just follow with mentioning that, again, this is a macro process, which means it's all organizational change. And so how that impacts staff really is that there might be experiences that we heard about or we learned about that didn't rise to the occasion, but it doesn't mean that they're not happening. And so what we want to try to do is create policy and change that affects everyone, which is why we're using the tagline, feeling welcomed and valued. At the root of all of our DEI work, it is around that we have noticed that people aren't feeling valued and welcome, and we want to make sure that that doesn't happen, both internally specifically, but recognizing that that is also happening externally. And so just continuing to relay that it's a macro process. We also recognize that there are some people within the organization that have a wealth of knowledge about this work, this body of work, and there's some people that this is their first introduction to it. And so because it's an organizational process, we move at the pace of the folks who don't have any knowledge about the issue so that everybody can come along. One of our values in this process is that there's nobody that gets left behind, right? So that everybody gets to be a part of it. And we also recognize that there are some folks that haven't engaged yet. So we're taking another step to connect with teams and folks who maybe are not necessarily savvy in how we've spent out the communications. And so we're wanting to go to crews, we're wanting to talk to other teams to really make sure that we still get input from everybody as we move along. So those are just some other key things that I wanted to share with you. That the extra outreach that we're doing, the macro process. And then lastly, what we also learned, at least in the first meeting, because I had a meeting with senior managers, is that a lot of when initiatives are actualized, the brunt of the work or the heavy lifting happens in the senior manager pool, right? And so we want to make sure, one, that senior managers have what they need, but then also that they're feeling valued and welcome, since you know, manager inconsistency came up as a response, right? And so we know that the impact in any change in an organization is felt specifically with the senior manager team. And we want to make sure to add that level of equipping and support to make sure that the brunt of the critique as well as the process doesn't sit there, and that it's kind of felt and carried by everybody in regards to this process. So that's what I'd add. And I am definitely open to answering any questions that you all might have.
Questions, commissioners, for Cheryl?
Well, I just, this is Commissioner Wolf. It's great to see you again. I really enjoyed our discussion, the time that we were interviewed, that I was interviewed. And I just, hold on, my phone is ringing it out. I don't know why. Is that, can you hear that in the back? Oh, jeez. I'm sorry about the interruption. I just, I'm kind of a holistic person in my thinking, and I wonder what your thoughts are about how the commission should or should not be involved and what part we play in your program.
So I think when I think about organizational wide and impact, I think largely the movement would happen with staff. That being said, I think there are where you sit in regards to the policy making, I'm not really sure. I would lean towards folks who know about how you all engage. But I would say generally speaking, this is a staff-led, staff movement process that happens. So I would probably lean to others who probably know a little bit more about how you all operate to be able to give some clear guidance. But traditionally, when I have organized and supported organizations, it's been staff-led.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Any other questions, commissioners? Cheryl, have you met much resistance when you've been working with different groups at the utility? Are these meetings always voluntary participation? And can you tell us a little bit more about how that's going?
Yeah, so I think how it shows up. So when people first hear about DEI, they have their own perspectives because of their experiences, right? Or what is it? Maybe it's from the media, maybe it's from their, you know, things that they've seen or had experienced at other organizations. What I try to do is have a staff-led, self-led consent type of culture, which means you get to choose how to participate. Of course, we want others to participate, but we also know that there's many barriers for in people's perspective as to why they won't. And so that's why we take the approach of we're meeting folks where they are and we're going to them so that we can continue to evolve the initiative to be inclusive in that way as well. We are not leaving anybody behind, right? And so as we continue and move to grow, we want to make sure again that, hey, do you have what you need? Two, are you feeling valued and welcome? Because a lot of times, you know, when you start with persons like within themselves, right? Are you getting what you need? Then the emotional intelligence can build, the empathy can build around other folks, and leadership skills can build around other folks. But we are being intentional about taking care of PUD first. And so that's been an approach that has worked. I've heard that we've gotten rave reviews, and you know, we also have what we call a parking lot where we can also give feedback around, you know, if we need to do things better, but we're open to doing things better. We're listening a lot, which I think is a big part of this process. And we're taking the extra step to go out, but we've had great feedback thus far. And, you know, a lot of times people think that it's all about training, and training has never necessarily changed behavior, right? It is the experiences that we have with other people. And so what we're trying to do is create as many experiences as possible where people can reflect on how they contributed to a situation, how they would contribute to a situation, and how we can all be better in engaging with each other, understanding that we have a shared mission and vision around everybody feeling welcome and valued.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
And can I just add one more thing? I just want to mention that it's not the entire organization that is focused on those three focus areas. There are many, many employees that do feel welcomed and valued. This was just some of the survey responses and kind of the key topics, I guess you could say, that came out of the listening tour and the survey, but it's definitely not everybody, obviously. It's,
Yeah, I would agree. And also overall, you know, even when we talk to folks, one, they were so grateful to be at the PUD. I think there's a level of gratefulness and camaraderie in regards to the staff there. And so when you're asking, how can we be better? This is how staff reported, but also understanding that, again, like Melissa said, there are folks who are actually feeling valued and welcome. So we just want to make sure that that's the case for everyone at the PUD.
Great. Well, we're thrilled you're here, and thank you, Melissa, for finding her. And thank you, John, for taking us here.
Yeah, I'll just add on a couple of comments. The work that Sherelle and Melissa have done is really outstanding. I do think there has been an overwhelming acceptance of Sherelle, which has really been kind of the cornerstone, or we needed as the cornerstone to move this effort forward. And it was also in large part because of trying to clarify that we were going through this because it's the right thing to do for our staff and for the community, and for us as a organization within the community, not as a compliance obligation, not as something that we had to you know, just fix. And I say fix meaning from almost a punitive or a disciplinary perspective. We had to find out, you know, who was doing what wrong. Sherelle made the, you know, the right from the get-go, the process feeling that we wanted to hear from folks. And the approach she took allowed folks to open up. And that's where we got the information that, you know, we have set up as the three key priorities to address. And even in getting the folks who wanted to engage and be a part of the DEI committee, you know, we had a lot more folks that had, you know, showed interest that we could actually put on that committee, that, and they will be engaged in many other ways throughout the process. But good feedback from the DEI committee off the first training, good feedback from the senior managers when Sherelle sat down with them and started to kind of, I say train, but give them an overview of what the future holds and how we want to move the organization forward. So I'm really excited about this. And again, this is about culture change that does take a while. But at the end of the day, this is going to make us a much better organization. And when you have everybody in the organization, you know, feeling valued and welcomed and feeling they can come to work and you know, put forth their best efforts and feel comfortable, both safe and comfortable from a psychological standpoint, that's powerful. And again, I think it's going to take our organization even to a better place. So really excited about this.
Thank Commissioner you. Logan, I have to give kudos to Allison Jubb because she's actually the one that found Sherelle for us. And there were three or four of us that sat in on the interviews, and she was definitely stood out amongst the rest. So we should thank Allison for finding her for us.
Thank you, Allison. And I apologize for my bad memory.
Yeah, it took a village, believe me. Everyone joined in. Thank you.
I do remember that Sherelle was surprised to have been found. So
yes. But we
that's
got
all lucky. Part of our story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all part of our story. It's been great though. I can't tell you how wonderful just the area, the people. It's been great. And a lot of times it's really hard, you know, to do this work, but it's just been really a blessing to work with the PUD. So I appreciate you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sherelle. Thank you, Melissa. So next up is the water supply contract between the City of Everett with Brant Wood. Good morning, Brant.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, commissioners. So this is, again, just to clarify, Brant Wood, AGM of the Water Utility. So I'm going to click on here and go through. So just three real quick things. We'll talk about the background of the original 1991 supply contract, the main provisions of the new water supply contract that was negotiated between the PUD, City of Everett, and the other GIA participants, which are Tulalip Tribes and City of Marysville, and then next steps. So just as a background, there's actually two main contracts or two main agreements that that go into this. The first one, these both were entered into in 1991. The first one was between City of Marysville, the PUD, to lay the tribes. And that was basically an agreement where we all got together and came up with a way to build and pay for a 30-inch pipeline to serve some of the needs kind of in North County. That agreement basically just talks about how we pay our ongoing share of maintenance of that agreement, what we had to pay to be part of that agreement, and our capacity of the pipeline. So moving forward. So in our case, our share of that pipeline is roughly 16.55% or around 3 million gallons a day. And then the second agreement was, well, how do we get water to that pipeline? And that's the agreement we're talking about today. So it's an agreement with the City of Everett to sell the GOA participants water for that pipeline. And that agreement actually was originally set to expire July 1st, 2020. I don't know if you recall, but last year, June of 2020, we came to the board and said, we needed more time. The partners needed more time to negotiate the terms of the new agreement. That has been done now. And so we are coming back with the new agreement for review and for approval of the board, the tribes, and the City of Marysville and City of Everett. So, so main provisions of the new water supply contract is really similar to the 1991 agreement. There aren't a lot of changes. Everett agrees to deliver up to 20 million gallons a day to the GOA participants. And this is off a tap located off of 20th Street Southeast in the Caballeros area. There was a new operational plan that was developed between the parties to talk about impacts associated with delivery of the water to Everett and to the other participants. The only real change in the operational plan was that as we use water from the pipeline, if we have a change of more than 2 MGD, which is around 1400 gallons a minute, we need to notify the City of Everett of that change 1 hour in advance, just so they can make sure that the water flowing from the treatment plant, there's no issues associated with too much water being drawn off the pipeline. Everett continues to deliver high quality water. And we did have quite a bit of discussion about peak flows. So one of the issues that Everett has is if we're all peaking or if we're all have on the same hot day, we're all using a whole lot of water compared to our normal average flow, that creates an operational issue for the city. So what we talked about is that if based on the operating plan that we've agreed on, if that's working, great, there's no issues. But if it's not working and it creates an issue for City of Everett, they're peaking, an issue for the City of Everett, then we'll get together as a group and try to come up with changes to that. If that's unsuccessful, Everett reserves the right to implement peaking charges or demand charges based on that peaking. So if we can't come to an agreement that creates less impact to the city's system, then there is the possibility of peaking charges. I actually mentioned this when we're talking about the AMI project, that this has always been kind of there. It's been in the, you know, for not only this JOA agreement, but for all of our taps to City of Everett. If we're creating an issue for City of Everett, there's always been that potential that they could start charging peaking charges. Now, I haven't done it yet, but there is that potential. AMI will actually help us really determine the flows that we have, how much water is going to the distribution system and being used by our customers, you know, immediately. And we'll be able to kind of have a better idea of where our flows are, where they're going, and what kind of peaks we can anticipate for City of Everett, and work around that through mm-hmm. filling our storage, using more water out of storage. So.
I have a question, if I may.
Yes.
Grant?
Yes, yes,
go ahead. Can you hear me? Okay. Yes. This is Commissioner Wolf. So regarding rate increases for peak demand, so if there are a lot, for instance, if there are a lot of golf courses that are using a lot of water, are we going to be, I mean, in the Everett system, you know, the city and surroundings of Everett, do we pay more for the water that others use, or do we just pay for what we as customers use? Does that make any sense? I'm not sure if I know what I'm really asking here, but I mean, I don't really think that golf courses should be using so much water. A lot of them are recycling water now. They're reusing water, you know, which is great. But on the customer level, are we paying for water that is, it, from my point of view, wasted?
So good question. Others.
Pardon? Good question.
Irrigation is definitely one of those things that creates peaks. So in the summertime, the high use is caused by those peaks. So yes, if what this agreement says is that the JOA participants, so again, PUD, City of Marysville, and tribes, we need to work together on the amount of water that's going through this pipeline to minimize those peaks. So to answer your question, there is an agreement between the three parties that, hey, we're going to cooperatively work together to try to minimize those peaks. If one of the parties is unsuccessful, it could have an impact to our what we pay to take water out of this contract, basically, in this one pump station. Now, this is a fairly small amount of the overall water that we purchase from City of Everett, so we really do have most of the control over how we operate and how we peak. Again, good planning. You know, we try to make sure that we have enough storage to deal with those peaks. There's always going to be peaks in the summertime, and there's always going to be those high days. So today is probably going to be a rather large, you know, although it's not a weekend day, it's going to be a higher use day than, let's say, December. So, you know, we might, you know, send out 8-9 million gallons today, whereas in the wintertime, it might only be, you know, 4 million gallons a day on average. So that's our peak. It's like a peak of 2, or if that's the case. So I think it was a good question. You know, again, in this agreement, we are agreeing, you know, with the three partners to keep our peaking low enough so that it doesn't impact the City of Everett's treatment plant and their pipeline up from an operational standpoint. So it's not necessarily, you know, whether we agree or not agree on the types of use. What we're saying is we're going to, through good management of our own systems, through use of our own storage, through really knowledge of when we need to be turning those pumps on and off to supply our customers, trying to minimize the impact to the City of Everett. Just like we would like City of Granite Falls and the people that wholesale water from us to not peak off of us just on those really hot days, mm-hmm. but over, you know, try to keep that peaking factor as low as possible. So mm-hmm. that average day, trying to keep the peak as close to average day use as possible. And again, irrigation is the vast majority of that peak.
Right. So as customers, we are charged for how much we individually use, but at the same time, overall, as I understand it, rates could go up for all of us. Is that kind of the bottom line?
That's correct. If the partners don't work together to make sure that the peaking doesn't cause operational issues, the City of Everett has left it open that they could come back with peaking charges for use off of this agreement. So they
do you know if they're promoting conservation of water in their education?
Conservation of water. So regionally, we're part of the regional program for conservation of water that Everett spearheads. And regionally, between us and every other, so again, Everett serves 80% of the water supply to Snohomish County. We're part of that same group. We're part of the conservation effort that group has come up with. So the education, the fixtures, the low flow shower heads, and so those kind of things that we give out to our customers every year, that's part of that regional program.
Thank you for your answer.
You're welcome. So again, the rates and charges are established by ordinance from time to time. I think just from our past conversations, Everett typically does the rate ordinances in 4-year cycles. So the current rate ordinance is 2021 through 2024, and that's what we're working on right now. And there is no distinction at this time between the water that we purchase wholesale from City of Everett through the JOA contract and the water that we purchase from City of Everett just at any of the rest of our taps. We pay the same amount right now. Again, the only thing that possibly could change that is if Everett decides to do a peaking rate on this source.
Okay. Hey, Brent.
Yes.
Just really quick, I thought I'd jump in and ask you this question just for context. When we are on, when water is on the AMI system or in, the Connect Up system, would we be able to offer, like we will on the electric side, time of day rates and other type of rates that would encourage conservation on the water side?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so that's one of the things that when we come back to you, so we got a couple, and I think I mentioned this when we had the AMI presentation. A couple big things still coming up. One is a review of our water system plan. So still working on that. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting closer. But we'll come back to the board and talk about our water system plan, the demands, the necessary capital improvements that need to be made. But also as part of that, we're required to, in a public hearing, to talk about conservation rates and whether or not the board is interested in seeing conservation rates. And if the answer to that is yes, we definitely want to look at conservation rates, whether that's time of day rates, that might be a little bit more challenging with AMI for water because we're not getting, we'll get 6 samples per day. So the time of day might be a little bit tougher on that. I mean, you could definitely look at seasonal rates. And that's just because of the battery. So water meters, they have to operate with a battery. So they're not taking 15-minute samples like on the electric side where you could really kind of narrow into that potential time of day rate. Brian Booth would be much better at trying to explain this than me, but for water, you're going to get six samples a day, basically. So it's going to give you that total water that's gone through, up to, 4 to 6 times. And that's try to save battery life. So time of day by hour might be a little bit challenging to really implement, but definitely, seasonal rates. And again, for water, for the most part, wintertime flow, inside use flow is pretty consistent. Where we really see the peaks and where we really see the, a big push is the irrigation. So it's people making those decisions that, hey, I want to keep my yard, my 5 acres that's all grass. We all want to keep that perfectly pristine and green all year. There's a cost associated with that. So we could have tiered rates. We could look at tiered rates. We could look at seasonal rates. There's a lot of things that we could look at. And as we go through that first process, I think one of the questions will be, is it something you want us to really look into? And if the answer is yes, whether it's a tiered rate or something like that, then we would go back to our financial consultant that's working right now on a potential rate package, revised COSA potential rate package for 2022, 2023, 2024, more towards the end of the year. And we could give the board then options and look at, you know, whether we do just a standard, you know, standard COSA and a standard rate that is split between the different commodity types based on the COSA cost of service analysis, or if we want to look at something like a conservation rate is definitely something that's open at that point. And again, what AMI does, it's not necessarily, it allows customers to really understand what the impact's going to be to them for the most part. Whatever rate design we choose, the customers will have that feedback. Instead of having feedback, you know, before it was every 2 months you got a bill and it's like, oh, wow, I use way too much water. Every month right now you're getting a bill. Oh, I guess I water too much this month. It's if customers need to or want to, they can go in every day and look at what they're using and really can make that decision to, wow, maybe green yard isn't the most important thing for me. Maybe I don't need to keep my yard green. Maybe I let it go brown. So that's my philosophy because one, I don't, you know, I have a pretty big property and it takes me 6 hours to mow my yard when I have to go mow it. So I never water. I like it when my yard turns brown, except for the weeds, they stay green because I don't have to mow once a week for 6 hours. So that's a positive thing for me. Plus I don't want to pay for the water. But again, AMI will give our customers that feedback so that whatever rate we use, whether it's just the standard rates we've been using in the past or something different, something more intended to really focus on conservation, it gives them that feedback that they need to make the decision for themselves. Does that make sense? Did that answer your question, John?
Yes. Yep.
Great. So next step, we'll be coming back at the June 15th meeting for review and approval of a resolution authorizing the general manager to execute the water supply contract between City of Everett and the JOA participants. So you'll see the cover sheet, the resolution, and the actual agreement for your decision on June 15th. Any other questions, thoughts, concerns?
Commissioner Brent.
This is Commissioner Wolf again. This morning in the Herald, which we get every day and weekends, there was a big article about the Lake Stevens Sewer District. Are we in any way affected by what's going on with the sewer district of Lake Stevens and the city of Lake Stevens?
No, I mean, they're both partners that we work with. We work with the Lake Stevens Sewer District and we work closely with the city of Lake Stevens. So they are merging at some point and it has been somewhat controversial at times,
right.
But both good partners that doesn't okay. necessarily directly impact.
Okay, well, thank you. I was just curious about that. Okay.
Grant, what's the term of this new contract?
It goes until 2050, so the end of 2050.
So this won't be back to us for a while.
It won't be back. I'll be really old by that time.
All right. Any other questions, commissioners?
No.
All right. Thank you, Brent.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Brent. Good job. Next up is Aaron Burke with the interlocal agreement with the City of Bothell for the North Creek Trail. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning. I'm assuming you guys can hear me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Perfect. Well, again, good morning. I appreciate you being able to work me into the agenda today. Again, my name is Aaron Burke. I'm currently the manager of Distribution Engineering Services here over at the Op Center. And today I'm here to talk to you about an interlocal agreement associated with the City of Bothell's North Creek Trail Extension Project. From a district standpoint, this is a relatively small project, so correspondingly, this is going to be a relatively short presentation. However, if you have any questions as I go through it, please feel free to jump in. Now, Leela, I am not able to forward the slides.
You just click on the presentation. It should let you.
Gotcha. Thank you. So a little bit about the city's project, the North Creek Trail project. This is actually they're calling it Section 4, Phase 1. Man, I still can't. Okay, here we go. And this project for the city represents Phase 1 of an effort to construct the last remaining segment of the North Creek Trail project within the city of Bothell. Phase 1 will extend along the south side of SR 524 from Filbert Road to 207th Place Southeast. Now, the North Creek Trail, for those who are not familiar with the project, is a connector trail. It's a shared use trail that's meant to connect the communities of Bothell, Mill Creek, and Everett. So this piece that we're talking about right now is a very short segment along SR 524, and you can see it in the slide there. Currently, the district has four 12 kV distribution poles that are in conflict with this segment of the trail alignment. Of those four poles, three of them are currently located on private easement that the district has with those property owners. Because we have private easement there, the city is responsible for paying the relocation costs associated with relocating those four poles. Because of this, an interlocal agreement has been drafted to address the city reimbursing the district for these costs. Now, the interlocal agreement that we are presenting today represents the mechanism for the city to reimburse us for those costs associated with this relocation. Finally, the timeline is tight. Currently, the city plans to begin construction of this section of trail in July, so next month. So what this interlocal agreement covers? It covers, like I said, a mechanism for the city to pay us for the cost of the relocation. So the city of Bothell will be responsible for 100% of the cost of relocating the three of the four poles that are on easement on a T&M basis. We estimated that at about $56,000, but we're for the purpose of the interlocal agreement, we estimated $60,000. Also associated with this work, and because the district is relocating three poles from private easement into right-of-way, we will be vacating an easement. And so that easement has value. Our real estate folks came up with a determination of the value of that easement of $42,000. And the city will also, under this interlocal agreement, be paying us for the value of that easement. So next steps, like I said, this is a short presentation. In order to support the city of Bothell's construction timeline, I mentioned earlier that they're targeting July to start. We are planning to introduce the resolution for this interlocal agreement at this afternoon's session on the individual consideration, items for individual consideration agenda. Concurrently, the city's folks are presenting the same interlocal agreement at today's council meeting. So that they may be doing that as we speak. I'm not sure what their timeline is, but they are reviewing it and approving it today as well. That's the goal. And upon authorization and approval by both the district and the city, this work will get released to construction to be completed this month is the goal. So that is the project in a nutshell. Please chime in with any questions.
Any questions, commissioners?
Thank you, no.
Not hearing any other. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. Well, I'll be available this afternoon when you see it. And if you have any questions then, please feel free to ask. Thanks.
Excellent job, Aaron. Thank you.
Thank you.
So next, go ahead. Okay, next up is David Popich and Zach Scott with the 2020 Reliability Report.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. My name is Zach Scott, and with me is Dave Popich from System Planning Protection. We will be presenting the 2020 reliability statistics, some additional analysis based on those statistics, a deep dive on one of our substations, and some of our future plans that will help improve our reliability.
Did I have control right now, Layla?
You just want to click on your screen and for Zach.
It's not doing it. Did you give it to Zach or to me?
I gave it to Zach.
It should be for me.
Okay, I'll switch that one more, please.
Thank you.
Okay. Our reliability improvements have been focused to fall within the four strategic priority categories. For operations, our efforts and equipment aimed at improving reliability work better when system operators, field personnel, and engineers are on the same page and know how our equipment is intended to operate. System protection has provided training to system operators and field personnel to ensure devices are working correctly and faults are identified and customers are restored as quickly as possible while remaining safe. To meet the customer experience priority, we continue to identify outages that affect the most customers and develop strategies or install equipment to reduce the impact of future outages that occur. For the safety and team priority, system protection in conjunction with our field personnel attempt to inspect all our field protective equipment annually or replace equipment that is not working as intended. We also work to ensure our documentation and instructions for field equipment is up to date and clear for personnel working with them. To make cost management a priority, system protection analyzes where improvements can be made for the largest impact reliability and how to implement projects together that will provide more operational flexibility, possibly allowing more restoration opportunities. With that, I will turn it over to Dave, who will go over our reliability statistics and some deeper analysis we performed for 2020.
Thank you, Zach. Some terms that will be used throughout the presentation are SAIDI, the total duration of an interruption for the average customer in minutes. So that means a SAIDI of 60 is the average customer is out 1 hour a year. KD is the average time to restore service to a customer who's experienced an outage. So a KD of 60 also means that it took an hour to restore a customer who's experienced an outage. And then SAIFI is how often the average customer experiences a sustained outage, which is 5 minutes or more. And a SAIFI of 1 means the average customer had one outage in a year period. A major event day is where a SAIDI in a 24-hour period exceeds a threshold. This number in 2020 was 13.66. This is important because major event days don't count against our overall SAIDI, as you will see in later slides. This graph shows the 2020 reliability numbers compared to 2019 and the 5-year average. There was an increase in all three categories. The biggest increase was in SAIDI. These numbers are what we call blue sky outage data, which doesn't include major event days or planned outages. Outage data that includes major event days and planned outages will be referred to as total outage data. We will go into detail why we think this year was worse than others in the next slides. An important note about the 5-year average is that the number of outages recorded in 2017 and beyond increased as compared to previous years. This is because outage records are automatically generated now rather than manually entered prior to 2017. Weather can greatly impact our annual numbers. Days where the SAIDI was greater than 50% of the major event day threshold are directly related to weather. These days are usually a combination of wind, rain, snow, and trees. In 2020, there were 9 days where the SAIDI for the day was above that 50% major event day threshold. In 2019, there were only 3. The purpose of the major event days is to keep exceptional days from skewing the statistics, allowing reliability analysis to be based on typical days. You can see here on October 13th, we just missed that threshold by 1%, which would have made the typical day numbers look better. So a year with mostly calm days and just a few major event days will have overall better reliability numbers. Having extended periods of inclement weather can worsen both the blue sky numbers and the total numbers. You can see here on this graph that there's the 4 days that are below the red line on the graph. Those accounting for almost 30% of our blue sky SAIDI. I want to also mention a sneak peek into our 2021 data. On January 13th of this year, we had a major event day that contributed a total of 285 minutes for SAIDI. If we did not separate this day, then our SAIDI would have already been doubled of 2020's for 2021. Utilities report their numbers to various organizations like IEEE, the Energy Information Administration, Utilities and Transportation Commission, and more. I found that these reports did not yet have 2020, so we won't be able to compare that. But here are 2018 and 2019. See, 2019 was an overall great year for us in all categories. In 2018, looking at the data without major event days, we also did very well compared to Puget Sound Energy, Avista, and Jefferson County. Again, you can see here how big of an impact, how big of an effect major event days have on our numbers.
This is Commissioner Olson. I do have a question on that slide, just for me for comparisons. Did you choose these utilities because they had, in terms of rural and urban and suburban, there was some similarities there? Because with Jefferson, I'm assuming that's mostly rural.
I chose Puget Sound and Avista because those two were available. And then I did find also Jefferson, but there wasn't any reason why I chose Jefferson. Okay. Those were just available.
Okay. Because comparisons like this are really difficult to make, are they not?
They are, yep.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
To further analyze the cause of an increase this year, we further dive into distribution faults only. This does not include faults on our transmission system, any planned outages, or major event days. When an outage is entered in our outage management system, it is automatically categorized as overhead, underground, or secondary using our GIS system. We can see roughly 1,900 of our 2,353 outages took place on our overhead system. More than 95% of our SAIDI came from overhead. Underground outages typically have less of an impact because the outages are more commonly equipment failure related, which is in most cases transformers. Transformers don't have many customers on them, so this translates to a low effect on our SAIDI. For overhead, it's opposite. This is because overhead outages are typically on our laterals or main feeder, and this results in more affected customers.
Don't we have a lot more overhead customers too? Doesn't that skew the numbers?
I believe we do, but it's not greatly different. Zach, do you know that?
It's very hard to quantify because a lot of customers are not overhead or underground all the way back to the substation. So even customers who do have a portion of their service underground, there will be portions overhead.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you.
And keep in mind that these numbers reflect the entire customer base. So SAIDI includes the entire customer base, not segregated by either or.
Right.
To give us some scale, we have almost an equal amount of overhead and underground lines. So I think we have about 3,300 miles of overhead and 3,000 miles of underground.
Wow. Hmm. That surprises
like
me.
So this graph here shows that outages are much more common on our laterals. However, they don't have as significant of impact on our SAIDI as outages on the feeder, because typically a fault on the feeder will take out the entire circuit or up to the first protective device, the breaker at the substation or a recloser. We have similar data in 2019 with the number of outages. However, feeder SAIDI was roughly 8% less. This is the type of data that helps us make decisions on our system. Of recent, we focused our tree trimming on feeders over laterals because of this. This table breaks down our circuits into urban, suburban, and rural area. You can see the average SAIDI, SAIFI, and number of outages are fairly similar for urban and suburban, but significantly higher for our rural circuits. The column on the far right shows that the average number of outages for rural is 15, while for urban and suburban, it's only 3 and 4, respectively. To show visually what an urban and rural circuit look like compared, we provide a figure of that. Here I compare two circuits that are in the east area, Snohomish 123 and Woods Creek 1809. These two figures are on the same scale. Woods Creek 1809 is 10 times the size of 123, but almost exact in the number of customers. In this table above, you can see how much more of an impact a rural circuit has on our overall system performance. Woods Creek 1809 contributed 35 times more SAIDI than Snohomish 123. On this chart, we focus in on the actual cause of outages. While trees are 40% of the outages, they're behind 70% of the SAIDI. This is an increase from 2019 by 12% on both number of outages and SAIDI for tree-related outages. Mm-hmm. Tree outages are directly related to weather. A year with more wind and snow will result in more tree-related outages. In the appendix, we have a graph showing that that 2020 did have more intense wind events than 2019. So that could account for some of that difference. So what are we doing?
I'm surprised on that graphic. I'm sorry. How much is equipment? Is that normal? Is that reasonable?
That did increase slightly this year compared to 2019 and 2018. And it did increase from our 5-year average. There isn't really a root cause of that we are aware of yet, but it's definitely something we're going to keep an eye on going forward.
Okay.
I have a question. I hope it's not unrelated. Is this possibly related to the inertia equipment that has not been performing properly?
Most of this is transformer failures. The inertia switches, I'll actually talk about a little bit later.
Okay.
Are most likely not the cause of this equipment number going up.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
So what are we doing to improve reliability? Distribution and substation projects in one or multiple ways always improve our numbers. This can include replacing poles, replacing conductor, old switches, undergrounding parts of circuits, relocating circuits, and substation reliability projects, and more. We've continually been improving and focusing on inspection and maintenance, which I'll mention in the next slide. Auto sectionalizing schemes have been added each year and will continue to be because we're noticing great impacts from these. System operators have been performing switching requests to quickly restore customers that can be. We've completed 459 miles of tree trimming in 2020, and we've added two new single-phase reclosers to our system in the past year, which is technology we haven't had before. In 2020, there were 7 substation system reliability projects, which include replacement of an old transformer, replacing circuit switchers, adding or upgrading auto sectionalizing schemes, performed maintenance and inspection, and more. We've completed 112 inertia switch replacements, which were found to be a safety concern. We completed 88 pad mount switch inspections. We continue to do our annual field device inspections on regulators, reclosers, and capacitors. We completed inspection of 26,000 wood poles and treatment of 14,000 wood poles. And we were able to replace or install 13 reclosers and 16 regulators in 2020. When possible, manual switching is done by field personnel at system operators' direction. In 2020, there were 434 outages that benefited from switching. These 434 outages affected 225,000 customers. We were able to reduce outage minutes from a potential of 54 million minutes down to 29 million minutes for these 435 outages. This should be 434. The total outage minutes for 2020 was 42 million minutes. Through switching, we were able to reduce our total outage minutes by 37%. In 2020, there were 382 faults on our feeder. 122 of those benefited from a recloser. As we saw in the chart before, feeder faults impact SAIDI much more than faults on laterals. These 122 outages could have affected 160,000 customers, but only affected 68,000. We were able to reduce outage minutes from a potential of 49 million minutes down to 12.5 million minutes for these 122 outages. In the last year, the district has installed two new single-phase reclosers. These are much different than the existing single-phase hydraulic reclosers on our system for a number of reasons. Faults clear in a vacuum bottle instead of oil. They're much smaller, easier to install, more cost-effective, and easier to operate. The intent of these devices are to install them in remote locations with long traveling time, high fire risk area, install them at laterals with frequent momentary faults, fuse coordination issues, and large number of customers. Some benefits we'll see from this device are decreasing the number of outages, decreasing truck rolls to outer county areas. It's a cost-effective way to improve reliability for a customer without installing a very expensive three-phase recloser. It can mitigate wildfire risk, and this gives us a chance to collect and analyze data for a device that could be a part of our wildfire mitigation plan. They're also capable of communicating through our AMI network, which will be a huge advantage for us in the future. Next, Zach will talk about auto-sectionalizing.
Just Commissioner Olson, excuse me, I do have a question on the slide you just left, the single phase reclosers. Yep. Now, is this like a proactive program, planned program, or is it reaction to a problem?
To change them out. So when I say this is a new technology for us, we're not specifically going in replacing hydraulic reclosers with these. We are replacing hydraulic reclosers on our system, but these are going to be mainly looked at for high fire risk areas and laterals with large number of customers and areas where there's a lot of momentary faults. So yeah, I'd call it more proactive.
Yeah, it's more of a plan. All right, thank you.
David, were these the devices that we were briefed on that I think it was Index we were serving or we're installing some?
Yes, we installed six of these on a gold bar circuit that has typically really worse numbers compared to other circuits on our system. So, I mean, we don't have enough data yet, but since installing them, we actually have not had a outage yet on gold bar 554.
That was my next question. Good.
We don't know if that's luck, if that's weather related, but
right.
It's been good news so far.
Thank you.
And that I'll take it to Zach now to talk about auto-sectionalizing.
Okay, thank you, David. The district has implemented auto-sectionalizing schemes on our transmission lines that attempt to automatically isolate faults and restore customers. In 2020, we saw some excellent reduction in outages due to these auto-sectionalizing schemes. Four transmission line outages were completely mitigated. Five other transmission line outages had fewer substations out of service than would have been without the auto-sectionalizing schemes. We continue to expand the use of these schemes, adding or upgrading three schemes in 2020, and we hope to do another four schemes in 2021. To determine a priority for which circuits to improve in the past, we would look at the 20 worst circuits for SAIDI and SAIFI. This made sense at the time, as it should highlight the worst performing circuits in our system. However, we had a problem in that we saw mostly the same circuits on the 20 worst circuits list every year. As we showed in the previous slides, the longest rural circuits with the most trees will have the most outages and thus the most SAIDI. Rather than look at the same long rural circuits every year, I wondered if some of the shorter circuits were performing worse than they should. The theory was that more reliability improvements could be made on circuits that hadn't received as much attention due to their shorter length. The list you see on the screen now is a priority list we developed to identify circuits that are performing worse than they should based on their length. The first two on the list are a perfect example where the second circuit on the list was worse with SAIDI and SAIFI, but the top circuit is significantly shorter. Because this is a relatively new method, we will watch this list to see how many circuits repeat on the list. The more I've worked with our reliability statistics, the more that I've noticed the 80-20 rule applies. I've seen this with a relatively small number of our circuits have a majority of the outages. I've also seen that a small portion of the outages we have contribute the vast majority of the SAIDI for our entire system. Looking at overall system statistics don't tell a very clear story when most of our customers have one or even no outages, and a few have significantly more than that. In order to better focus our efforts, I wondered if these lopsided statistics apply to our substations. What we found was that four of our 94 substations account for about a third of our customer minutes interrupted. With Woods Creek accounting for 10% of our CMI, or customer minutes interrupted, we decided to take a deep dive on why the CMI was so high.
We found that Woods Creek. Back on that previous slide, Eagle Creek is a new substation, isn't it?
It is, but we have numbers for that for when it was called the East Arlington.
Okay.
So same station, same circuits, just the name change.
Okay.
We found that Woods Creek had 97 outages on it in 2020, with 75 of them being on circuits 1808 and 1809. On 1808, the average customer had four outages and was out of power over 19 hours. On 1809, the average customer had six outages and was out over 14 hours. While these numbers were higher than our five-year average, the customers on Woods Creek, on average, have three outages a year with 11 hours of outages, both extremely high. We next wanted to know what was causing these outages. We looked at the circuit lengths and found that Woods Creek circuits total about 256 miles of line. This means that there are lots of opportunities for the conductor to be damaged, especially by trees. As you can see in the table on the right, tree-related outages accounted for 84% of the CMI for Woods Creek. To put the reliability for Woods Creek in perspective, we need to understand what improvements it already is benefiting from. Woods Creek has benefited from manual switching when outages occur, helping reduce the outage impact. The transmission line that feeds Woods Creek has an auto-sectionalizing scheme that operated multiple times in 2020. And finally, feeder faults were mitigated for Woods Creek by the eight reclosers on the four circuits. With all of our typical methods of improvements being utilized, we had to think outside the box to try and improve the reliability for Woods Creek. Given that over 80% of the outages were tree-related in conjunction with tree trimming guidance, we are proposing changing the tree trimming frequency on some of our worst performing circuits to 5 years from 7 years. Along with this increased frequency, there would be a mid-trimming cycle inspection of these circuits to see if there are any trees that pose a risk of damaging our lines. With these changes, we would like to keep a record of fault locations on the Woods Creek feeders to see if any patterns emerge. Making these changes will provide data we can use to estimate safety improvements compared to the costs involved. Finally, given that over 90% of our outages occur on overhead lines, we propose to investigate converting a portion of the overhead lines on Woods Creek to underground. We predict that this will almost eliminate outages on the portions of line that are converted to underground. Doing this would also give us an alternative cost basis for reliability improvement. With that, I'd like to cover the upcoming major projects that will help our reliability.
This is Commissioner Olson. I have a couple of questions on the slide you just left. Overhead to underground, isn't that a ratio of like undergrounding is like 10 cost 10 times more than overhead?
I would say so.
So as you're looking at that, I'm assuming that that will all factor in terms of balancing the cost versus the benefit versus the number of customers.
Yeah, that's why we're not going to claim that we're going to do it at this point. We're just going to investigate the kind of come up with an estimate of the cost see what that would compare to the safety improvement.
Okay. And then on the, I just wanted to pass on compliments, reducing the, reducing 7 to 5 years for your trimming cycle. But the fact that you're going to be, maybe you're now doing it, but doing a mid-cycle inspection. I don't know if this is new or not, but it certainly is a positive step.
Yeah, we're hoping that it'll provide some good results rather than looking at them once every 7 years, getting eyes on them more often.
Yeah. How about a drone?
It sounds good to me.
Sorry, I didn't mean to be cutesy.
I have a question, Zach. How many customers are on the Woods Creek section?
On the substation?
How many accounts are affected by the Woods Creek area?
I don't have the number, but it's in the 5,000 to 6,000 range total.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Hey, just a really quick comment to Commissioner Olson's point and question, which were both very good. And Zach and team do this very well, but also factoring in the, underground cable typically has a life of about 30 years. So you also have to factor in the tree trimming cost for those benefits, the cost benefit analysis as well.
Yeah, agree.
As well as the occasional vehicle accident and or other overhead risks, liability risks.
Yeah.
Reliability risks.
I was intrigued by the mid-cycle inspection. Is that something we don't normally do? Would this be a new thing?
I think that would be a new thing. They kind of, tree trimming shared with us how long it takes to do the notifications for a given circuit. And I think with the amount of time that it takes to just get a circuit ready for tree trimming, that they typically did not have time to go back and inspect other circuits that had already been trimmed.
Yeah, it just makes it seems like there's an opportunity to take out whole trees when necessary, if 3 years after a trimming. It may not just be trimming, it may be there's trees that are, a little bit of snow load or a little bit of wind or just gonna push over or something. Anyway, I was just intrigued by that idea, but I can understand that the challenge of permitting individuals and the cost benefit of that.
Okay. Tree trimming is in the process of working on Woods Creek substation right now, and they will be expanding this enhanced tree trimming schedule to other substations soon. The Woods Creek to Lake Chaplin tie will provide an additional way to restore service to approximately 2,000 customers on Woods Creek 1808, where we haven't had a way to restore customers if the location of particular faults, if they occurred in a disadvantageous location. We plan to continue to deploy the single phase reclosers to see how effective they are and if they should be used more widespread. Finally, in the near term, the Twin City substation will replace the North Sandwood substation, taking what was 5 circuits and breaking them into 8 new circuits. This will reduce the impact of any of those circuits experiencing an outage. The new substation will also have our modern protective relays that will enable more communications and control to the substation. In the next few years, the Sky Valley substation will be built near Woods Creek substation. Sky Valley will reduce the loading on Woods Creek by roughly 50%. The load growth center from Monroe is just north of SR2, so the new substation will alleviate currently exceeded planning guidelines and provide necessary capacity in the future. The North Camino Ring Bus will allow us to better utilize the lines serving the North Camino substation, providing two sources in an attempt to reduce outages to Camino Island. For the distribution automation communications, ConnectUp is installing system-wide communications. The district will upgrade existing equipment and install new equipment that will take advantage of the ability to communicate with our system operators. These communications will integrate with our fault location, isolation, and restoration, or FLISR, application in DMS, allowing for a self-healing grid as part of the vision of the utility of the future. FLISR uses fault current data from our substation relays to estimate the location of a fault for faster investigation by field workers. In the more long-term timeline, we plan to build the Getchell substation in the North County area, which will provide immense operational flexibility by breaking up transmission lines with several substations on them into shorter transmission lines with fewer substations. This will allow the implementation of more auto-sectionalizing schemes and permanent outages to affect fewer substations. We will also continue with the implementation of our DA system by upgrading and replacing devices that are not able to communicate with our DMS system. The more of these devices that are installed, the greater the improvement in reliability and operational flexibility. Are there any questions?
Questions, commissioners, comments?
This is Commissioner Olson, because I think not too long ago, we had a customer inquiry about frequent outages. And I thought that staff was able to actually to go in and study the circuit that this customer was served by, and actually was to give a great deal of detail to the customer to explain what was happening. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, so the way we used to do that is I would have to go through all of the records and try to pick out the ones that were, you know, impacted. And with about 3,000 outages a year, it took a while. Now with our OMS system, I can just type in the customer's address and it'll bring up all outages that affect them. So yes, we can do that much more quickly now. And if, you know, that if more customer requests come in, we can handle those.
Yeah.
Great question?
Great job.
Thank you.
You know, I just will say this is exciting stuff. And I think our customers, the more we can get this information out to our customers, the better. And I know we have done some things to try to get that out there, but I think customers just sort of think of us in a simplistic way that the wind blows, trees fall down, the power goes out, cars hit poles. And every time I've had an opportunity or I've seen us engage with customers around all these devices, reclosers, sectionalizing, I think they're very impressed that, yeah, some people are going to have power outages, but we might be able to minimize the amount at any one given time. And so I think that really separates us from the non-public utilities, that we can do this work, especially in these low population rural areas. So thank you.
I think it would be a really helpful thing if we got on the agenda of the city councils of Index, Sultan, Goldbar, and have someone do a presentation. Because I think you're right, Commissioner Logan, that people really like to know these things and they would be very interested and grateful.
Yeah, I got to participate in a conversation, it was a couple of years ago at a Stanwood Chamber of Commerce meeting, mm-hmm. and people were just riveted to understand the systems in place to mm-hmm. sectionalize, especially in Camino Island, which has, you know, notoriously been a challenge for us. So I would agree. I think that's a great idea.
So those three, though, I would hope that we would seriously consider getting on those agendas in presenting to those city councils.
Well, I think
a lot of people are attending those virtually now, those city council meetings. They're not going in person as much. So anyway, that's my hope.
With the analytical tools we have, we can custom tailor presentations for different areas. So if Fulton and Goldbar, you know, we could bring up outages that are particular to them or improvements that we're making particular to them. Same with Camano Island. We can really hone in now and find outages that are applicable to customers in those areas.
But kind of an overview of how it works is helpful too, because, you know, I think it's really important that we not talk down to our audiences. We just give them credit for, like Sid Logan said, you know, they're very interested. And I think, at least that's what I have found. So good luck with that.
All right. Thank you, David. Thank you, Zach.
Thanks for the comments.
Great job, Zach.
Great presentation.
Thank you. Yep. Great job, both Zach and David. And just really quickly, a couple things. We have upgraded or enhanced our outreach regarding information through Julie's team, the corporate communications team on reliability, all the different things that we are doing, investing in the system, and even tailoring some of those. Certainly we do that with our key account customers, but in other forums to try to get the word out of what we are doing to continue to enhance reliability. Also, just a huge kudos to Zach and David and the entire reliability improvement team. They have really taken great ownership in evaluating our system, the outages, worst performing feeders, outage causes, all the stuff that they just did a great job going through and really have come up with some great ways to continue to enhance reliability. And you know, again, we're in a part of the country where at the end of the day, weather is going to play a huge impact on year over year numbers, right? We could say, oh, we had a great year in 2019. If you really go back and look, or 2018, pick a year. If you evaluate the weather or analyze the weather impact, that's always going to have, whether it's the wind, snow, other types of things, because the predominant amount of impact from weather does not get excluded through the major event day calculation. That usually will only take on a huge storm 1 or 2 days. 2 days would be even pretty significant. So it usually takes out about 1 or 2 days worth of Sadie. And if you think back over the number of storms that we have, just wind events, it can be minor. That plays a huge difference or has a huge impact on the numbers. So the things that the team keeps doing to mitigate the impact of those weather events is huge. So great job.
I wanted to add one thing, John. As we move out into the eastern part and the northeastern part of our service territory, fire is going to be a major issue. I know they're already having a fire just over on the east side of the mountains. And there's a report that the higher elevations are experiencing more fire. So, you know,
And we're all over that. I think we gave a very brief mention of that a few commission meetings ago, and we'll have another mm-hmm. update on that in months to come. But we have a team. In fact, I think David and Zach are both included on that mm-hmm. in that process and on those teams that are working on our fire mitigation
plan. Great.
Very important. Anything else for our meeting this morning, John?
No, that should do it.
Okay, well, it's 10:34, so we do have time to take a couple of public comments before we go into executive session. So if you'd like to provide a public comment at this time, indicate that you'd like to speak by clicking raise hand in Zoom, or if you're joining us by phone, dial *9, and I will call on you. We have Gayla Shoemake. Gayla, go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hi, good morning, commissioners. Nice to see you this morning. I have a question, Sid and the other commissioners. I know there's a couple of questions. First, I know there's a solar project that has been approved by, I think it's by Commerce, but has not yet been funded. And I'm interested on where that project is located, because as you know, I have bought into the previous one and I definitely would like to be involved in this one. And the second question is, there was a comment that was sent to one of the Edmonds newspapers wondering where the additional electricity was going to come from when we get rid of all fossil fuels. And I know that the PUD is very good at planning for the future. So I'm interested in the plan that you all have for the future when we no longer have natural gas, when everything is electric. Where are those additional sustainable energy projects going to be? There may be something else other than wind and solar. Those are the only two I know of now. But I'm just interested in your plan. Again, I know you're very organized and you plan that in the future, and I'm just interested. So thank you very much.
John, are those questions that we can answer today, or do we need to get back to Gayla?
I have a general response, if I could. Let me lower my hand. I think there's a lot that goes on, Gayla, that is very complicated that people don't hear much about. And John is, and Sid and I and Tony, we all are represented on the associations, and there's a lot of planning and discussion about other ways to meet our demand, other than just what we hear about week to week. So maybe John or Sid would like to, or somebody else would like to respond, but there are many things being discussed as ways of meeting our future demand, other than just hydro and nuclear and what we have. So that's just my general response.
John, we have Jason. Okay, go ahead, Jason.
Good morning, and you can hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Gayla, right now we are working on our integrated resource plan, which looks at, how we will meet all of our future load needs. And we'll have more updates, couple more updates coming to the commission this year on that plan. You're absolutely right. There's going to be a lot of renewables. And I think one thing that we're going to see is a need for storage. So, renewables are not dispatchable. We don't know when they're going to generate. And so there'll be a need to shift that energy from when it's generated to when it's actually needed by the customers. We just recently talked with the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and they're seeing many of these similar things in their studies as they develop the power plan for 2021. So those will be two reports coming out that will really speak to that question.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
And again, I had a question about solar also.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that was the community solar project.
Right, right.
I'm not exactly sure where that's going to be located.
Ethan, I've asked Pam to jump on and give that update for us.
Okay, thank you.
Morning, hi. Pam.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Pam Bailey, senior manager of Customer and Energy Services. It's going to be in the Everett location. We still haven't completely solidified the agreement yet, so it is a possibility that it can change. But right now, it's in the city of Everett in their low-income area, so that it'll benefit our low-income customers.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is there any other members of the public? Oh, go ahead, John.
I was just going to add one more comment to Gayla's, and really an excellent question on the resource concern or thought. And I will tell you from my experience over the last, well, really since I stepped into this role, but certainly over the last 12 months, that is the biggest topic discussed, not just in the Pacific Northwest, but across the country, is resource adequacy, especially with the move to try to go carbon free. And quite frankly, they're not being good alternatives for storage and or others to make up for the lack of generation that is coming offline, or even to in areas that cannot build natural gas, who have you know, zero emissions or carbon free legislation in place. So it is a huge topic. Just about, I would say 80% of the meetings that I'm in, NERC meetings, WEC meetings, CalISO, the resource adequacy is a huge, you know, concern and opportunity. And as Jason said, we've got some of the best as far as talent and experience working on our IRP, but it'll be, you know, there'll be a lot more information to come on what the future holds in that regard. But I would also remind, we are actually in a great place with, you know, 97%+ carbon free where we are now, and all the work that we are doing, not only from a resource or a supply perspective, but we've got our distribution teams working on how do we best maximize our distribution system, and through conservation, through the Connect Up program, all these things that really are part of the utility of the future that will help us maximize the resource portfolio that we do have. But a great question, Gayla.
I have just a quick, excuse me, go ahead, Gayla.
No, I was just saying thank you. I knew that was going on. I'm just very interested. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Quick question, John. Do you have any idea how the U.S. compares with other countries on storage development?
No, we could get that information, but no, not in detail. I will tell you that we, actually a previous company that I used to work for has one of the biggest battery storage projects going on now in California. Mm-hmm. It's actually a collaborative effort. I think it's roughly 2,000 megawatts, and Jason may be able to correct me, 2,000 megawatts of storage capacity that they are hoping to be able to bring online, you know, I think within the year. I believe that was part of their mitigation plan for the summer, for this summer. That's the biggest storage project, battery storage project that I'm aware of in the country.
That's correct, John. And it was a little bit delayed, but they're hoping to get it online, you know, kind of before the late summer, I guess. And, you know, when the reliability would really be a concern. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Is that going to serve a different region of the U.S.?
That'll serve California.
Oh, that's for California. Okay.
Yep. And I was just going to add, you know, I know PSE is also working on, Puget Sound Energy is working on their IRP as well. Mm-hmm. And that would be another good resource, as well as Avista. And some of the other things that folks are looking at is, you know, natural gas replacements, such as synthetic natural gas. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you know, the technologies, the generation technologies that folks are going to switch to aren't necessarily identified in the IRP. They just kind of have a placeholder there, knowing that they're going to need some generation, but they don't know exactly what technology they're going to utilize. And that could be the same for storage as well.
So hydrogen is one, isn't it? Or is that just for new energy, or is that for storage?
Hydrogen would be one as well. Uh-huh. And it could be used for both.
Okay.
There's some thought that, you know, you could use the renewable generation when there's excess renewable generation to create the hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. And Gayla, you know, my last response to you would be the pilots we're doing, the three pilots will get at this too. So that's, you know, that's our challenge is managing our peaks. It's our peaks when we have to go out and buy energy that's been produced by fossil fuels. So all three of those pilots are things that the community will do. And, you know, electric car charging, of course, is the real obvious time of day opportunity that we expect that customers will have in the future so they can charge their cars at non-peak times that will help us get to 100% clean. So, all right, thank you, Gayla, for your question.
Can I follow up just really quickly, Sid, please?
Sure.
Isn't that also being considered as car batteries for storage?
Yes, and that's one of the features that we are testing as part of the microgrid is the what they call V2G, vehicle to grid capabilities, where you actually have battery storage. If you have an electric vehicle, you would actually have battery storage that we could take back out on the system during capacity needs.
That is particularly exciting.
Yep, it is.
Are we going to get a little break before our executive session?
We will.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Gayla. Are there any other questions from the public or comments? Please raise your hand. Okay, I'm not seeing any. It is now 10:46, and the board will recess into executive session to discuss legal risk of current practice or proposed action under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. It is anticipated the executive session will last approximately 45 minutes with no public announcements. The regular meeting will reconvene virtually at 1:30 p.m. So commissioners and staff, it's 10:46. Why don't we give ourselves about 10 minutes and convene at 11:55. Does that work, John?
11:55?
Yes. 10:55, that's sorry.
And I'm not actually in this morning session, so
okay.
Take as long as you want.
Generous of you. All right, we'll be there at 10:55.